Mr. Swill Canem, the flight of the two. Let's see, back to that, the two swallows, and it's off of Works for the People, Swill Canem production. This is KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia, your listener supported, volunteer powered community radio. And this is Make No Bones About It, and we're going to be hearing from L. Frank tonight in a few minutes, probably. Let's hope. And L. Frank is Tongva, is a native California Indian artist, tribal scholar, cartoonist, language advocate, singer, and self-described decolonizationist. L. Frank has exhibited her artwork, paintings. She was up here at Evergreen at the Longhouse, I think, a couple of years back. Painting, sculpture, weaving, photographs, cartoons, and regalia. So we're going to talk to Elle tonight about the revitalization of the culture, the Tongva, and the canoe, the Tiat, I believe that's how you pronounce that. I think Jesse shared with us about a couple months back. We should be hearing from Elle pretty soon, and we'll play another music. I want to also thank our friends from the South. There's beautiful words listening very deep in my heart, and been thinking a lot about the words that were shared, talking to a lot of folks these days about the way our earth is and how we have to work together. We're in that time, and I think we've always been in that time, but I think we're more aware of it today than any other time on the planet, and it's really important for us to come together and do the work and respect each other and love each other and move forward as people, human beings on the planet. And we all need to heal. We all need to, the earth needs to heal. And I would, for one, want to still be here for a little while anyways. I know that we all have that cycle. Kid with people these days, because I'm getting older, halfway through my journey, but I still want the other half, and I want us to come together and to really, really, really come from the heart and do the work that needs to be done on this planet. So that's my little rant for the day, and I just know it to be true. So I'm thankful to be here in the Northwest, and thank the First People for allowing me to be here and to share. And so we're gonna play another song. Let's see here. We'll get this one here. We'll just do a Warrior Paddle Up song and Remembrance. Here we go. Thanks for listening. You are listening to KAOS 89.3 FM here, Olympia, and that was Remembrance, the Paddle to Quinault, Honor Our Warriors. And we do have Al Frank on the line, and I'm really grateful for calling in and to share with us, to give her the opportunity to introduce herself and talk a little bit about what you've been up to these days.
Okay, now?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I'm pretty laid back. And,
that's all right then. There was no 3-2-1. That's cool. Yeah, Netwanyene El Frank None Tongvet Kukovet Koi Ahashman Koi Raramuri. Usually I just tell people I'm a Hollywood Indian because that's close enough.
That's funny. If anybody knows, you know that's not true.
Well,
yeah, you just live near Hollywood. But I wanted to first talk a little bit about, I've been following a little bit of what you've been saying on Facebook and many other places, and, being a tribe and not being recognized, and how, you're the first people, I think, in the L.A. area, if I'm not correct.
Yeah, L.A. and San Juan Capistrano are my two tribes, and Ahashmem from San Juan Capistrano, and we have relatives out on, Pimugna, Catalina Island, and Minar, Island of the Blue Dolphins out there, San Nicolas. It feels terrible not being recognized. It sucks, is what it is. It's a perpetual burr under your saddle of, no, you don't exist. No, your paperwork isn't in order. No, these people came here then. This and those people went there then. And it's just always a jumble. And what I was posting about was an organization that's a really good organization. It's got really great people in it, and it's got great, vision. I don't like to use the word mission. But, they're hampered by certain things. And those certain things, other organizations have other things that they're hampered by. So there's always something that reminds you that, you're a stranger in your own homeland, that you have to become somebody else. They keep forcing us to become someone else. We're not going to be. We just have less and less and less say and opportunity.
Yeah, it's like being exiled in our own land. And wanted to talk, with the, I know a lot of the tribes down there. I have a really close friend, and he's like a brother, Ray Ward, and Chumash are coming back and very strong. And that you're a part of the waterway and making a tiat, a canoe down there. And how did that all come into being?
Wow. Well, that's a long thread that I had read about, and I'm sorry because I'm not good with dates, but I had read about the Chumash and how they had worked with a museum at Santa Barbara and gone out to sea. They had made a tomal it's basically the same craft as ours, different ears at times on it. But it's they took it out. And so that was incredibly inspiring to me because, it just was. I lived near the ocean most of my life, and so the thought of that canoe going out to the islands was just incredible to me. And around in the 89, 90, somewhere in there, with the man from up in Occidental named Jim Noyes and Cindy Alvitri from Tongva land, they decided, well, she dreamt it, and he decided he was going to help build the first tiat in around 200 years. So we built that down in Santa Barbara, and that was an incredible moment. I saw how it galvanized community. Even though certain community members were glaring at each other, they were still there, They still showed up. And therefore, they were inspired by this also and could take it back to their own factions if that's all it was. But at least some cultural stuff was getting through. And so I had since then always wanted to, felt that it was a sin to only have one, because that makes it a showpiece more than anything, you know. So, not that a culture has been revived. So, I've always wanted to, but it's an enormous undertaking. It's quite a bit of money these days. It takes people who know what the heck they're doing. So, all these things, you know, are difficult, especially the somebody who knows what they're doing, because it's such an ancient watercraft that I doubt anthropologists would use the word ancient, but I am. Such an ancient watercraft that it's complex. It's really, really complex. And so it takes somebody mathematical, you know, and a builder to get some of the, to be able to build some of the nuance. So it was because of Jesse, of Chiyakawe that you mentioned, that and Canoe Journeys, that the second one came about. We were at Canoe Journeys, I think it was 13, might have been 13, and watching Protocol. And it was an incredible day, you know, just an incredible day. And towards the end of that afternoon, I heard Chiyakawe calling me, and what he was asking was, can we do that? Can we, you know, build a canoe and be a part of Journey? Because of everything that Journey means and what that would mean to the Tongva people and to natives. Just, you know, seeing that, doesn't matter where they're extinct from. There's lots of Indians extinct from all over the U.S. It's just an inspiring thing besides all the other good things that, that Journey is about. And so I said yes, even though I thought, well, that's absolutely impossible. So I said yes, and fortunately a friend who lives in a forest took down a tree and milled it and delivered it, and a friend who had never seen one of these, he's Wailaki, Kineste, Ethan Castro, he was able to figure out the math because of Ray Ward. Ray and actually Tima and Steve Villa and a whole lot of other Chumash people were able to guide us, because they've built, I think, 4 or 5, 6 of these now. So then she came into existence and was drying, literally, their glue and her paint on the way to Washington State to join Journey.
So is the tree, it's a redwood, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and so it takes a few months to put this all together. I'm not a math genius, so it would probably take me a year.
Oh, it took us 3 weeks because we had that much time before we could not join Journey.
And so, I mean, it's very empowering, you know, because all the folks on the coast had canoes, and I mean, it's the largest resurgence of indigenous culture across the planet right now, if I'm not mistaken. And so, to be able to be a part of that, it must make your heart really big to. I don't know. It makes my heart real big to know that it's happening and that the culture's alive. And I know that you, through language, you're able to also, the songs come when you're out on the canoe and those kind of things happen. So that was that first step, and then coming up, because I live close to Jesse, so I saw the Tiat out front, and so and all that happening. I know that you said, Jan, I think he was talking about how the songs were coming, and this is a revitalization of the culture.
Well, yeah, I am very involved, have been for a long time in language, but the music part of it is Chiyakawe, is Jesse. He is, I'm musically not so much there. Words come, but that's about it, which is a lot considering I'm extinct. But he gets songs. They just flow into him. You know, it's as if they've been waiting somewhere and for somebody to open a door and, you know, let the floodgates of song hit. Because going up Journey, you know, you need to perform it not perform as entertainment, but to perform at protocol as part of a journey. And we were able to do that because of Chiyakawe. And we created two dances. It was funny. We first started working them out in Washington, D.C. at a language conference we were at in the dorm room, figuring out the frog dance, what that might look like, and Chiyakawe's mother, Lydia, you know, what the red-winged blackbird dance might look like. But where these songs came from, you know, I kind of saw the genesis, and it's really this pure thing that I'm awful proud of, and I really didn't have much to do with that, but it was just a wonderful piece of journey. There were many incredibly huge moments to journey, and that began with when the wood arrived, you know, and then not even talking about when we were up there, how incredible that was.
So, and I'm reading through your, I read through your bio, and you're a weaver too, among artists. Your art, I've seen the crows on the nose page. We talk a little bit about some of the art, how you got involved with that, and the kind of weaving that you do. And
well, I was on the California Indian Basket Weavers Association board for 15 years. And I really was more interested in, I do weave. I consider myself one of the coaster queens. My starts always manage to be really nice, and then I have no idea why they don't go any further than that. But I really like different parts of weaving. Like I like the gathering, to go out and gather, because everyone goes out to gather, and there's always babies, and there's always food, and you know, and I just love holding the babies, and you know, everybody's so elated every time they get a 12-inch, you know, root from a, you know, that's going to just be a beautiful weaver. So I'm totally into a lot of other things, and against I worked against herbicide pesticide usage, because weavers pretty much everywhere use their mouth for a third hand. And let alone digging around in pesticide, herbicide areas, you know, ingesting this right through your mouth. So it results in a lot of, I'll call them injuries. Well, I guess they're injuries and deaths. You know, so reviving and keeping your culture of basket weaving alive is a tricky thing with all the chemicals in the world today. And as far as my art, I think I've always been a doodler. And yeah, I've always been a doodler. So I've always gone to, I don't have any degrees, but I've always gone and to different colleges looking for art. Like I used to sneak into UCLA to use their photography department, you know. Or I went to Immaculate Heart College because Sister Carita Kent made silkscreen and I wanted to make silkscreen there. You know, I just wanted to, so I kind of went places, but you know, never got any degree.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at some of your art, and I love the use of the color that you use. And let me see if I got this one right. It's Moila. That piece is really beautiful. Can we talk a little bit about that piece?
At the embrace of Moila holding the moon?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually the first real painting I ever did with acrylic. I was a photographer, you know, so my grandmother passed away, and I was so devastated that my partner just said, well, let's go, and we picked up art supplies, basic art kit of brushes and acrylics, and I doodled about a bit, and then I painted that, and that's, it has to do with the passing. It has to do with death in the world. It has to do with a red-legged frog being embarrassed because a leader, a captain, a chief, lost his erection for her in front of everybody, you know, in the village, and she ended up killing him, and that's how death came into the world. And Moila is the natal name for the moon. It's the moon's name. So I just love that, and I was able to embrace, more or less, embrace the passing of my grandmother.
It's beautiful. It's a really nice piece, and I can see, like, through the eyes, you know, the heavy thinking. There's a heaviness to it.
Yeah, somebody once thought it was called shiny vagina, just because I had found there's a triangle there over the genital area on the dress, and it's because I had found this book of old plains style, real old style plains clothing, and they all had beaded triangles over that area. And so I liked it so much. So that's the reflection from the moon to the womanhood. You know, it's another. I was a feminist minor at Immaculate Heart. I'm sorry, but that's that. You know, an homage.
Yeah, and so can we talk a little bit some more of your art, like the some of the wearable things? And I just I did a little bit of art in my day, but I wouldn't consider myself an artist, but how do you go and create, because you're into a lot of things, and so what inspires you when you get started?
What inspires me most is ignorance, and I don't know if that's mine or ignorance of others, and you know, and I dislike ignorance, and so there's a whole lot of ignorance in this world, so there's a whole lot of things to be attracted to. You know, it's all nonstop. If I make art, I made a stone bowl, first stone bowl, it's a large cooking pot, by someone in my tribe in about 150, 175, 200 years, I'm not sure, long time. And what I was inspired by was because it didn't, I saw that we used to do them, and I thought, oh, you know, I didn't have a clue. I was clueless. Being a native from L.A., you know, there's not a lot there's not a lot of your culture left for you to learn from. And so I said, I started investigating stone bowls in the United States and in Europe, and so then I made a bowl. I had never worked stone before. So it's now at the Oakland Museum.
Oh, and talking about not much left, I know because of the missions and things that have happened through California, and how it affected native people there, and especially during the 1850s, I think was called the Black Period of time, and how millions were eradicated. For the land.
Yeah. What's your question? But yeah.
I mean, talk about how the missions. They're still there, and is there any way of, I know that they still have things of the first people of that land there that you're able to access.
Well, I used to access them at the Mission Dolores, because they had a little low fence and I could reach over and touch things. That's how I tend to access things. You know, they don't. They don't have to, because they're private, and this is how they get money, so they don't. They don't have to follow rules. The little book I made, Acorn Soup, it has a lot about the missions, a lot of response to mission, because there's, I don't know, I can count on one hand the artists who have responded to the missions, and so mine are, you know, like I have one where there's a mission, and instead of the Vegas, it's skulls, and there's a little welcome mat at the door, and it says, welcome, Franciscan showers. You know, people look at that and go, isn't that nice? They're so nice to the Indians, gave them their own showers. It's like, really, no, that refers to Holocaust. But there's not much mention ever. I'm sorry, I'm struggling with this. There are so many examples that they're all flying in trying to be the first one. So I'll slow down and talk about it. I was working for three museums at once, the Santa Barbara Museum of Natural History, the Skirball, and the Japanese Museum in Los Angeles. And I was with the Japanese people and the Jewish people, and we were on a bus headed for the Santa Barbara Museum. And we were interviewing elders from each community. So we were on our way to interview a native elder, a Chumash elder. And as we pull up in front of the mission in Santa Barbara. And everyone was so delighted. They just said, oh, the mission. And they got their cameras out, and they started to run off the bus. And I stood at the front of the bus, and I got that speaker, and I said, wait a minute. what do you think this mission is? You know, and I'm there working for the Japanese National, you know, Museum that has nothing but dioramas of Manzanar and you know, all the other camps. And I said, this is our summer camp. This is what we all have in common. This is what we all have in common right here. And only one person then took a photo. The rest of them realized what it was and had a whole different attitude about it. You know, but they were caught off guard. They'd never been taught. Heck, they were in America. Why would they had ever been taught that this might not be good for somebody?
Yeah, I remember the last time I was in Santa Barbara and Chumash territory, and we went into the museum there, and my wife and myself were noticing, like, they had these moccasins, probably about 100 pairs of them. They were donated from some wealthy person, but we were just like these belong to somebody, and they were taken. It just was really, I don't have a word for it. My heart was just like really sad.
Right. I was standing in the museum at Sacramento, and there were a bunch of us natives there. I can't remember the event. And a group of them were talking, and there was a canoe. And as I walked up to them, they said that a few summers ago, this canoe was in their backyard, in their homeland, on the edge of the river, and that a truck pulled up, and nobody stopped them, and they put it in, and now it's sitting there. And you know, it's hard because there's all this paperwork that says, no, this is that, so it was bought, it was this, it was donated, you know, and so it went. So, you know, I work with a couple of museums, the Hearst Museum. I'm on the first Native Council they've had in 112 years, and so it's a tenuous relationship, you know. It has to be bridged, though. Missions, museums, all these places, they have to be approached by us.
Yeah. Is that the we were talking earlier tonight about healing, and I think more people need to know what they really are, and it's up to the Native folks that know what they are to talk about it. That, and I know it's hard because I find a lot of elders when they have to go back, you know, it's very traumatic, and it triggers stuff in them. And so it's very hard to talk about it. And the genocide that had happened here, it's very hard for anyone to talk about it, but we got to talk about it. It's a part that has to be, it's a healing that has to happen.
Yeah. I was going to say there's a gift to that reliving the horror. When the elders tell us things, there's a gift for them, and that gift is there's a lot of gifts to that, but they have to be able to get past that. You see that a lot with language. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you find with language, because English is the main language I speak, but I know bits and pieces of the old language, but do you find that more youth where you're at are wanting to learn, and how would one learn if Tongva, if that's their ancestry and they want to learn it, how would they go about it?
Well, learning it now is easier than it ever was. Learning it is easy, but it's difficult because it's easy if you were good in grammar. It's a little more difficult if you weren't, but it is absolutely possible, and more than that, to learn the language. And I find that it's people of all ages. There are a lot of young people, and in their mid-20s, and they have young families, and they realize that they want their children to have something. And since it's more out there now, more visible, more people are learning, it's become much easier to access the language. We've gone to all the archives. That's what Breath of Life was about. I created that I can't even remember the year. And it's based on what I used to do, which is going into a written archive, sound archives, baskets, anything that our culture produced and our people produced, going to those places that, and visiting those things. Well, a lot of people have done that now. And so we have a lot of accumulated information. So it's much easier to access these things if somebody were really interested. Facebook, well, I call it Facebook. There's a Tongva language class that's really wonderful. There are Tongva language classes held down in Southern Cal that if you went to that website, you could find out when they were. And Chiakwe, Lydia, and I were learning via Skype.
Yeah, so there's a lot of places people can go to mm-hmm. to learn, and that's wonderful. And just want to let people know you're listening to KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia. We're here with Al Frank, and I wanted to also, I know that you have a lot of projects and sharing, but can we talk a little bit about your book first, Acorn Soup, what that's about, and how that, you know, again, like I'm really, when I read your bio, like you really have touched all media. Like you've really gone into all media, and very creative person you are. And so I'm really interested in your creative flow and how that comes about and how this book came out. And I know acorns were a staple for the native folks there, and holiday time we get some chumash cookies that are acorn. And,
right.
Yeah, no, they're, if anybody hasn't had them, they're the best cookies I've had. So, so
yeah, they're pretty good. Got a little bit of flour thrown in them, though, so I can't have them.
Yeah, my wife ain't either, but
but keep saying they're good.
They are very good. I know I like them. So, but can we just talk a little bit about
sure.
Them?
Yeah, I had a brother, my brother who passed in April. He was, I consider, far more creative than me and far more prolific. I feel kind of like a slow thing after him. But the main reason I do a lot of, there are two reasons I do a lot or different things is because I'm easily bored. I don't know if it's my autistic bent or my dyslexia or what that drives that. I have to move from one thing to the next. At least I come back and finish things. But it's really that it's become, and it became very early this, that if, I sort of said before, that if people aren't, some people are not interested in stone bowls, and some people are not interested in cartoons, but they are interested in stone bowls. So you never know what is going to attract anybody and what is going to cause them to stop and just think. You know, just that's it. And so as far as acorn soup, I used to work at Camarillo State Mental Hospital, and I ran five units of, I didn't run it, I was an assistant, five units of mentally retarded adult people with behavioral problems. And I used to show them movies. It turns out that I found out I could order any movie I wanted, so I liked the Marx Brothers, so I would show them the Brothers, and I would show them Duck Soup. So acorn soup is really because of duck soup, but, you know, acorn soup is a food. That is a staple. You're absolutely right. The sacred food. One shouldn't make that much fun. But I just was randomly doing these little drawings, and honestly, I really draw about the same way I did in the second grade. And so I just did drawings, and as I was, I'm a real research geek, and so as I'm reading things that are really heavy, you know, that anthropologists have written in their anthropology speak, you know, and I don't have an anthropology head. And I'm reading all these things, and I'm mixing them with what I know and I've heard, and everything, you know, A plus B, so I get this tertiary, you know, if I add these two colors, I get this third color, and so a drawing comes out. So these drawings are really kind of mindless by me. I've talked about this, I think, in the introduction, that I have paper and I warm up, you know, on a piece of paper or a pen in my hand, and I put on my magic glasses. They're really just bifocals. I put on my magic glasses and then I start drawing and then I'm done. And so I really am not aware of the drawing until it's finished. And so whatever's on my mind, like one day it was a Chumash dude, I won't say his name, I won't say it. It's an old joke. I was really going to say his name. But, He really made me angry, and I felt it was his Catholicism that made me angry. And so there's a whole series of drawings about opting out of the choir and just coyote was running around doing all these anti-church things for a while. I haven't really shown that group to people, but, you know, so it's really just response to what was going on around me. And then one day I was at a meeting. It was Richard West was his name. He with the Smithsonian American Indian Museum. It's when they were coming around to different states asking natives what they would like to see in a museum. I was at one of those meetings, and I just happened to show Malcolm Margolin of Heyday out of Berkeley, and so I could hear him on the other side of the meeting. He would chuckle every once in a while, and so he just started putting them on the back of his magazine, and after about 5 years said, why don't we make these into a chapbook? And so it's in chapters, and they are responses to colonization, you know, and Coyote sells maps to the stars, because I am sort of a Hollywood Indian. That isn't our homeland. And, you know, but they're not maps to, like, Jane Fonda's house. They're, you know, it's about our cosmology. It's actually about our stars. You know, it's about astronomy.
And where the Tongva, I know that with the Chumash, that they were amazing with the astrology and celestial part of the world. Amazing. So were the Tongva that like that? Were they?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because part of our sand paintings, well, even a little further down, but we always considered the skies above us as part of our homeland. And you're going to find almost everywhere on the planet that indigenous peoples really, really had a handle on the stars.
Absolutely.
And knew when to plant, when to, you know, when to run, you know, when to cower, you know, when to stand boldly. You know, there were doctors who knew these things. Yeah, extensively.
Right, and I'm also as we're talking, just thinking about how the ancestors of the land there. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, the numbers that were there and the tribe itself, and how we can help, like really help advocate for I don't know if you want to be recognized, but to be recognized as a people down there, so that you. This is your land, and to be able to move forward in it, how would we be able to, you know, how many are still left?
Well, that's it's a complex set of questioning there.
Yeah.
I've been told that there are approximately 800 of us. We were the largest tribe in Southern California.
That's what I thought.
And, we had the islands to the left or the south of the Chumash, they had the Channel Islands, I can't remember their names at the moment. And we were over on our islands over at top where we had to canoe over to. A big piece of our culture, like Island of the Blue Dolphins, people love that story. Well, there was a real woman. We call her, I use her shortened name, thank you, Eric, we call her Damawumal, but her full name in English means lonely mockingbird. You know, she doesn't have anyone to speak to anymore. She was a young woman with a child, and the Spaniards took her off the island, and after she'd been separated by her people for 18 years. I mean, she was a real human being. She wasn't a child's story, you know, or a Universal Studios movie, 1966. You know, real story. I mean, a real human being. And Catalina Island, everyone loves to go to Catalina Island. Well, these places are part of Mother Earth. Up there where Island of the Blue Dolphins is, Minar, what that actually has to deal with is the umbilicus of Mother Earth. This is in our belief system, this is the center of our universe. This is Mother Earth's belly button. And the island pieces, Santa Cruz and I think that's its name. I always forget it. I say it's English names, but those are Spanish. And Catalina Pimugna, those are pieces of her eyebrow or her cheek or nose. So that's how personal this place is to us, you know. And then the mainland is a piece of her body. We were the largest tribe. We've been rubbed pretty hard. It's a miracle we exist. It's a miracle that so many of us have not really assimilated, although I do like technology. You know, but in our hearts we have not. And there are many of us trying to do cultural things. Now, with being the largest tribe down there with a huge land base, the remnants are, I think, at about 5 to 7 factions. And so the politics are pretty brutal because the government, the United States government, has presented us in a minuscule pie. By us, I mean all natives who want to be recognized, a minuscule pie. And so we're cutting each other's throats for it, you know, a piece of it.
Right. Like, we have a couple tribes up here that, like Duwamish, you mean, Chief South, they have a whole city named after them, and they don't want to recognize them as people. And the Chinook, I know from where I work that they did the first time in like 150 years, they actually recognized Native people, and they had a little exhibit at the Secretary of State's office, which I was really happy to see because that is part of the healing. But the lady that they used for the... a bookmark?
Yeah.
She's a Chinook lady, a grandmother. I can't remember her name, but this is a tribe that they're trying to say doesn't exist. And they're right up the coast. I mean, it's just crazy, the criteria. I'm all for the people.
Right.
They're the only ones that can tell us who they are.
Exactly. And, you know, as far as what can be done for us, well, I think that everybody by not just our tribe, but keep working on everything they're doing legislatively and, you know, make that faux pas look a little less attractive. I mean, you know, with change in laws, it's incredibly slow. But what are we going to do, have a revolution? You know, that's not going to happen. So it's what other natives accomplish around us actually benefits us, and I think that just everybody remembering who they are, that the government always says, well, if we recognize you, you're allowed to recognize whomever, but that really takes effect, that we all know who our families are.
Right.
And it's those things that are embarrassing. If we could end the embarrassing behaviors that our grandmothers and our grandfathers, you know, they told us that's an embarrassing way to act. This is your family. If we could remember that and not be so wanting of the pie, because everyone wants, you know, health care and education and I don't know what else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be nice if a place, at least in our schools, advocated for knowing who, you know, where the school's located at. I have this map that's getting spread around rather nicely, I'm happy to say. I took this map and it's a map of California with all the tribes, according to anthropologists, just this already created map, and California events, and California natives were free to write in whatever their tribe's name were called according to them. It was, my intent is for this to go to fourth grade, where you learn and study California natives. So that's where I used it at the Oka Museum when I worked in the education department with third, fourth, and fifth graders. And so things like that, you know, and we ourselves have to take great responsibility as to what goes on in schools. But it's so hard, you know, these days for any community members to educate themselves or to do research and or to take what their grandmother said and also work, you know, one or two full-time jobs almost, you know.
Right. But it's true, though, what you said, though. It is up to us. I got two kids, and my wife's very active, and we bring in that indigenous view into the school.
Right.
And, you know, let's not forget about the people whose land that we're on, you know. We talk a little bit about those folks.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are ways, you know. And I grew up in a predominantly, when I was a child, in a predominantly Japanese neighborhood, and... You know, I watched, and they sent their children to Japanese school afterwards. Well, why can't we send our kids to language school afterwards? You know, you're telling me we can't get a van to take kids you know, some place to learn language or to get some culture. If we're inner city, you know, if we're urban kids, you know, and I've seen many other communities besides the Japanese community sending their kids to, you know, giving them a little bit more. I mean, there's more we can do. We're just tired and think we can't.
Right, and I think that I remember who I was talking to. They call them culture camps.
There you are. Yeah.
And I know that they're there, and I know that some people are accessing them, and I think that needs to be on I think any of the schools' docket. You know, they need to have that as an option for folks.
Yeah, well, because in the fourth grade, I was in my mother and stepfather. We lived in an affluent area. The only brown kids in the whole school were myself and Johnny Rodriguez, and we were in the same grade. Well, there was a play which I ruined because I was made the doña, and John was the don of a hacienda, and our job was to sit on a porch and look arrogant while being served by Indians. And it wasn't until the actual play day when I was supposed to say a line, when I turned and I looked at my schoolmates, who were all really blonde hair, green eyes or blue eyes, and they now had these shocking, really, you know, clown black wigs, and they were wearing peon clothes, and they were giving us gifts, you know, that they had worked hard for, and I was supposed to act all arrogant. And I remember stopping, because at that time I didn't know I was California Native, and I remember thinking to myself, there's something really horribly wrong with this, you know, horribly wrong. And I ruined the play because I refused to go on. I refused to continue. And I just couldn't, because my 9-year-old self knew that there was something wrong. Well, what was wrong was I was in my own homeland, and they were portraying my own people and the subjugation, you know, and I was, and even as a child, even so far from that, that time period of history, it still felt bad. It still hurt me. It still made me sick. And so why can't we give a little bit more, you know, just a little more?
Yeah, and I know kids know.
They do.
They really know. They don't get as much credit as they should get, but they know what's going on.
Absolutely.
And the injustices. And my kids talk about it all the time. I'm like, who told you that? I know that I talked to them, but I was like, wow. It's like, yeah, I said, that's not right. Like, we had a whole thing around costumes, you know, for Halloween. Oh. And how they thought it was very inappropriate for folks to be dressing up as any culture, but, you know, especially Native culture, it's regalia. And so it's not right, Dad. And it's like, yeah, you know, it isn't. But it's up to us to, like, talk to those folks when we have a chance.
Yeah, my niece, when she was in school, and again, in an affluent area because her mother was going to a nearby university, my niece got a D on her report because it was on the Tongva people, Tongva Gabrielino people, and the teacher knew that they did not exist, therefore this child was lying, you know. And my niece herself had taken photos of us. I was there the whole time and written the report and put it all together, yet we didn't exist, and this child, she pays for it later on, you know, with a bad grade.
Yeah, I think, was that in the news? Because there was one in Southern California, I think it was Chumash area, where a lady, a young girl, I think she was like maybe 10 or 12, and she wrote a paper about the Chumash, and they said it didn't exist, but the mom came in.
Yeah.
She's like, wait a minute, we're here. And so, like you said, that dedication, I know that she, through the whole school year, she would come in. And she was very involved with that because,
right,
you know, they need to know that the Native people are still here. Gary, who does the show after me, he says it. It's been saying it for 28 years, you know. Our neighbors are all around us, you know. Go out and get to know them. You know, they're here, and this is their land that we're on.
Right, right. And, you know, we haven't been able to be the proper hosts in many ways, and that includes being able to stand up when things are wrong, because we have had the survivor mentality. First we were surviving, and then we had the survivor mentality, and now we're just, you know, a lot of us are in poverty, but that's a different kind of survival. And so now that we've, you know, risen up and looked around, you know, we are being more vocal. We are standing up, and it just takes more of us to do it. It's not a scary thing, and many of our people are very quiet. Well, go somewhere and stand quietly then.
Right. I remember once I asked an elder, why are Native people so quiet, and why are we the last to get our rights? And he says, we're just not pushy people. Yeah. We're very kind and loving, and we're not that way. That's their way. And so we'll go about it a different way. And I never forgot that.
Right. And that's the way that's exactly what we can do now. We can show kindness in the face of unkind, you know. We can tell people about our land, how the plants work, how the sky works, how the water works, you know. But somebody has to listen to us.
Right. And I really do think that more and more people are starting to understand, because it's people like yourself and many others that are out there sharing the whole hour that we just did is about sharing about.
Right.
And so I really feel that it's important. So that's why I come here every week, because let people know that the land that we're on and how the original folks of the planet think and where we have to go as a people. We got about a couple more minutes. Just want to give you a chance to, you know, if there's something that we didn't talk about, how people could view your art, where they could get your art, how they could get a hold of you, things like that.
Sure, any of that. I'm on Facebook, L. Frank Manriquez, and easy to find. And sometimes I put art on there. You can come over to my house and look at it. I've got a house full of it. Hoping to make it to Journey next year, hoping to build another canoe. Praying for the right people to come into the picture here. And I just want to, I don't know, I was looking at your website, and I was really appreciating the diversity of people and their efforts, and looking at that one sign that says it's time to warrior up, you know. It really is. And men and women, it's time. You know, I don't care how old you are. I don't care if you're a child. You know, I don't care if you're, I'm 62, come on, get up.
You're not 62.
No, I am. So, not that old, but still, I got some, you know, I got some wrinkles and stuff happening. So, it's time to warrior up. We've had a long time to rest, if you call that resting. But we're back now, and it, you know, we talk about the coal and the pipelines and the missing women and the battered women and the learning our languages and the learning our dances, you know. So we're in there talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly, but we need all of us, because there are too few of us. I don't want to be, you know, we are all one, but we are. We can support each other that way.
Yeah, that's why I like you talk about language, and I'm not Lakota, but I like when they say Mitakwe Asi, because it's not just about the human being.
Mm.
You know, when I think of we are all one, it's like very human-centric, at least to me anyways. And
yeah.
So, you know, whatever the you know, it's all of us, you know, the winged ones, the creepy crawl, everything. We're all in it, and we need all of us.
Yeah, as long as the creepy crawly things aren't in my tent.
Yeah, but you know, but we need to. I don't want it in my tent either. But you know, it's a.
Yeah. No, I dig what you're saying.
Yeah. So I mean, it's just we need everything here. The creation put it here for a reason. And,
right. And it's our job. Our job as human beings to watch over these things, and so that's all we're doing when we say to warrior up. It's that's our job.
Right, absolutely. And I want to just thank you for sharing with us this hour. And I hope that maybe we can continue this. And maybe when you come up, we can get you into the studio.
Right on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. You have a great night.
All right. Hatiach.
So this is KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia. This is speaking with L. Frank. And G-Dub is in the house. And I think he's got his dancing shoes on. I can't see him way in there. But I know that he'd be rocking out probably, so stay tuned to that dial, View from Ashore. We just got a couple more little IDs, and thanks for listening. It's going to be September next week. It is really hard to believe. School's coming back, and then we have Gary Farmer going to be calling in and Scatter Their Own on the 7th of September. It's real exciting, so thank you for listening.
Comments made during the preceding broadcast of No Bones About It do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, or underwriters of KAOS Radio or the Evergreen State College. Opinions expressed were those of the host and of the guests on the program. If you would like to express another opinion, address your comments to the general manager, KAOS, the Evergreen State College, cab 101, 2700 Evergreen Parkway Northwest, Olympia, Washington 98505. To arrange a time for your own commentary, contact the general manager at 360-867-6895 during regular weekday business hours.
And thanks for listening. It's about 2 minutes to six. I just wanted to let people know to get a hold of me. It's you can go to ravenredbone.wordpress.com, or you can go to Facebook, Make No Bones About It, either page. Or if you have any comments you'd like to, ravenredbone@gmail.com. And again, I'm looking forward to talking to Gary Farmer, who's he's a musician. He's also an actor. He's a sculptor. But I'm real excited to hear about his music. It's Gary Farmer and the Troublemakers. And I know they're traveling, and I'm thinking that they're heading up this way. But we're hoping to hear from him on the 7th of September. And then Scatter Their Own will be calling in and sharing what they've been up to. I've really enjoyed speaking with both of them, and hear their new music they have out. And again, it's exciting times. Thanks for listening. This is KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia, your listener supported volunteer powered community radio. Thank you. Have a good day. Have a good night, Amin.